Just wanted to say hello and welcome. My name's Habib Ahmed, and I'm based in the UAE and have been for the past 4.5 years working for the government staff.
Hi, Habiba. I'm Bernard Haeckel, a professor at Princeton University, and I work on the Middle East and specifically the Arabian Peninsula.
So I understand you've written a great deal on Saudi in particular.
I am interested in Saudi Arabia and have spent time there, a considerable amount of time there, because it's one of the least, well known, least studied countries. And it's huge. I mean, it's the size of Western Europe, and it's a very complex and complicated place. So I am in the process of finishing two books. One is an edited book on Saudi Arabia that comes out of a conference here in Princeton, and the second book is about the religious politics of Saudi Arabia.
And so I think the reason this is germane to this discussion at this particular time, two things really. In the last week, we've seen sort of Saudi, a lot of debate about the Saudi succession crisis or the politics or the transition phase that it's going through, given the death of its crown prince. And also the other kind of headline fact, which is that the New York Times recently published an article outlining a new security plans for a new US security architecture arrangement with the Gulf states. I've not seen anything that you published on these particular points. So
No.
if you could start by giving your take on these two
Yeah,
particular ones.
I have some thoughts about it. I mean, the first thing is that the Saudi leadership is quite old. These are the sons of the founder king Abdulaziz, who died in 1953. And I don't see them as having strong ideological beliefs other than wanting to stay in power. And because of that, it means that they are ultimately pragmatic leaders. I mean, they will do whatever it takes to stay in power, and they have certain principles by which they rule and by which they live. One of them is to be not just pragmatic, but to insist on stability, the stability both of the kingdom, but also the stability of the kingdom with respect to its regional neighbors and with respect to its foreign allies, most importantly the United States.
So in your view, you don't think it's the kind of the arrangements that have happened in the last week have any bearing upon the internal dynamics in Saudi currently?
I mean, they have some bearing in that we know that Naif is going to become the next king after Abdullah. The big question is not that, because that was fairly well known. The more interesting question is who would take over the defense ministry now that Prince Sultan is dead and he was the minister of defense. I mean, it has implications for the internal dynamics within the royal family and who gets what in terms of the pie. But I don't think it has real implications for either the domestic politics of Saudi Arabia or the foreign policies of Saudi Arabia. I think those will remain the same regardless of who comes to power.
Well, so I've got I see it slightly differently in that because it's a fairly sclerotic kind of regime, they're very old, in certain respects, there's almost a vacuum of strategic thinking. And they're not doing enough. And even though they're trying to sort of marshal their efforts, they're too kind of limited and constrained at the moment. And it's not the Saudi that it was 50 or 20 years ago. And the implications for that in terms of any kind of potential Gulf alliance are going to be very interesting in the next few years.
Yeah, I agree with some of what you said. I mean, I think that there is little imagination when it comes to policy towards Yemen or, for that matter, Syria. But when it came to Bahrain, for instance, the Saudis were very, very decisive, and didn't lack imagination at all. They wanted the regime to remain in power, and particularly the prime minister in question. And also, what I see them doing is ramping up an anti-Iranian and anti-Shia discourse or rhetoric that they feel is important in order to mobilize their own base of support behind them.
So my kind of concern is, even though it seems to be very stable and very contained and constrained in a way, except where it's of direct interest, such as Bahrain, in fact, in a sense, the course it's going on is in fact quite destructive, and as a GCC bloc, and I can kind of elaborate on that. But essentially, in terms of not intervening or not marshalling its resources, it's going to have a much bigger impact. And in particular, if we look at the spending packages that they've given out, I think it's now in the 150 billion mark since the unrest that the Gulf governments have committed to social welfare spending. And the kind of impact on that and the internal security and the internal stability of these economies in particular is tremendous. So even though it seems as if they're not doing, you know, enough, perhaps they're doing something in the wrong direction. And, you know, I think the ones to suffer eventually are going to be the kind of next generation of Gulf citizens, I think 70% of whom are under the age of 30 now.
Yeah, the Arab Spring events, uprisings or revolutions, however you want to call them, have coincided with a record high price of oil, which means that the oil producing countries like Saudi Arabia have a tremendous amount of cash in reserve that they can use as they please. And they've used that money, or some of that money, not all of it, to basically co-opt their citizenry and to calm tempers and essentially to politically break the backbone of any revolutionary or uprising movement, whether in Bahrain or, for that matter, in Oman. You know that they've given about $10 billion to Oman. In Jordan, they've given about $1.5 billion as well. So they have played a very proactive role in trying to buy off dissent.
Well, I think the commitment has been there, but whether or not they have actually spent that amount, they've committed to spending it, I think.
Right, but they've in so doing, they've sort of kicked the can down the road to the next generation.
Mm-hmm.
You're right, which is, you know, that some of the real problems, namely, you know, accountable government, transparent government, all of that sort of stuff is going to come up later down the road, when much of this leadership is now, it will be gone.
Mm-hmm. Well, in fact, I think it's even sooner than that. I mean, particularly when we look at this new NATO relationship that's going to come about. I mean, I think the US envisages it as a kind of a new NATO, but for the Gulf. And that there are tremendous kind of concerns with that, because, as you said, as to the lack of checks and balances, there's absolutely no way to hold any of these military machines or defense alliances to account, or, you know, in terms of the impact, there's no guarantees that it won't be used against domestic citizens, there's absolutely no there's no check or restraint upon that internally within the GCC. And we saw that very much with Bahrain, with Oman. It's a complete red line, and that, you know, I mean, there hasn't been a single article or any kind of critique from the Gulf as to the tremendous amount of military spending or surveillance spending, and yet it's among the highest in the world now.
I think also the repositioning of U.S. troops out of Iraq,
mm-hmm.
now that they're going to be withdrawing, and moving them into bases in Kuwait, but also in existing bases in Qatar and in Bahrain, mm-hmm. You know, spells that American force projection into the region will remain very, very prominent, and perhaps even more prominent than it already is. And it's quite significant right now. And I think that that is not a good thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll tell you why, at least for one reason.
Yeah.
You know, Al-Qaeda, one of Al-Qaeda's core demands has been the departure of U.S. and foreign forces from Arabia,
mm-hmm.
not just from Saudi Arabia, but from all of Arabia. And there is good reason for them to want this. I mean, religious reason, partly because there are injunctions, religious injunctions in Islam that say that you shouldn't have non-Muslims in Arabia. And so the fact that American troops are going to be very prominent in countries, not Saudi Arabia per se, but the other countries of Arabia, the GCC countries, means that Al-Qaeda will have yet again another reason to criticize these regimes, and perhaps even to start a new campaign of violence and terror in the region.
I mean, I
also think that the escalation, you're right. I mean, the spending on weaponry means that there's going to be a new arms race in the region between different countries, but especially between Iran and its and the Arab countries of the Gulf.
Mm-hmm.
And that, again, is very badly spent money, because it's not going to produce any of the industrialization or the economic development goals that these countries ought to be following.
Right. I think it's an opportunity cost between massive military spending. We saw this in Saudi, I think, in the 80s. A huge kind of buildup of its military presence and its spending on security and whatnot.
Yeah.
And it almost distracted them completely in terms of what the domestic needs were. And I see the UAE going in the same direction under the aegis of Abu Dhabi now, which is, again, of tremendous concern. And it becomes more kind of ultra-nationalist, the space for dissent, the space for kind of constructive criticism narrows incredibly. And in the absence of any participatory approaches whatsoever, it's a time bomb, given that, you know, again, the spending trajectory is off. It's completely off.
Yeah, and the irony in all of this is that none of these countries, whether it's Saudi or the UAE or Kuwait or Qatar, can actually defend themselves if Iran were to wage a war against them.
Mm.
They would need American military power to be there to protect them. So I think there's definitely a disjuncture between their desire for weaponry and you know, their ability to defend themselves. And I don't quite understand why they can't defend themselves.
Well, you know, I mean, I take a slightly different view in that I don't think it's necessarily altogether bad having such a strong kind of U.S. GCC partnership and military relationship in and of itself, because of existential, I mean, because of the threats that potentially are out there, talking Iran and incursion from other parties, for instance. But, you know, really, I think that the ball is being dropped. It's not even a matter of whether or not the military relationship should exist. I think it's the nature and the format of the relationship. If it doesn't come with safeguards or guarantees, that they're kind of very well placed to be in a very difficult position, both the US and the GCC. And Bahrain was, again, the perfect example of that. When you've got arms being supplied to Bahrain from various parties, whether or not it's the US or the Russians or, you know, whichever particular group, there's no, because of the absence of safeguards and because of the lack of understanding of the Gulf within, sorry,
that's my phone
no problem.
Going off. Can we just pause for a second?
No problem. So just to reiterate, we're talking about the lack of understanding, in particular among US policymakers and even within the Gulf, as to the kind of long-term implications of doing this. There's very few that would understand the kind of internal dynamics within the U.S. political architecture, it seems, and, you know, you've got the defense and the Pentagon that seem to be at loggerheads with often with what the State Department sort of seeks to achieve in the Gulf. And I think this is going to be played out because they're not proactively requesting guarantees in terms of this security spend. So I don't think it's necessarily it's not that it's a bad thing to have such an alliance. It's just that the shape and structure of it and the implications of it need to be studied much more closely. And if they are going to invest a tremendous amount in sort of building up new bases in Qatar and in Kuwait, which I think that there won't be any problem with at the highest levels in terms of the government and the rulers and that kind of thing. But certainly, yeah, there will be fallout.
Yeah, I mean, I see the new policy of force projection, which is really a continuation of a policy that started in the 80s
mm-hmm.
by the United States into the Persian Gulf region. I mean, I find it very problematic, I mean, both as an American, but also as someone who studies the region, because on the one hand, I think that as an American, given the austerity right. measures that we have, the fiscal problems we have,
mm-hmm.
you know, extra expenditure right now of this kind is unwarranted. The second reason is that I think that having such a huge military presence in the region is an irritant, both to the domestic population. I mean, Al-Qaeda, as I said, you know, was a reaction in Arabia to the presence of military forces in this way. And secondly, it spells, you know, an arms race. It also spells an increase in militarization in the region and
And
therefore the
therefore,
possibility of a war. Like, for
for
instance,
instance.
I'll give you an example. At the moment, we know that Saudi Arabia dislikes intensely Prime Minister Maliki in Iraq
Right.
and considers the Iraqi government to be a Shiite, Iranian-backed, Iranian sort of led,
Led
even puppet, Iranian puppet regime
There's
in
some
Baghdad.
truth. I mean, there is some truth to that, too.
There may be some truth to that. I mean, certainly many of the leaders, the Shiite leaders, had sought exile in Iran and were protected by Iran throughout the Saddam period. But let's say that now the Saudis and the Iranians wish to fight a proxy war in Iraq using different factions in Iraq. In other words, reigniting a civil war between Sunnis and Shiites. I can't see American forces and Western forces in the region remaining neutral, especially if Iran feels that it's losing this battle or its proxies are losing this battle and starts provoking or irritating the United States or attacking military forces of the United States. I mean, this has happened in the past. So I really think that this new period we're going into is a very volatile period. It's a potentially a very, very violent period, militarily speaking. And it's a quite worrying to see this happening.
I think
And I
I
think
mean
that.
when yeah.
Go ahead.
Sorry.
No, go ahead.
No, when you talk about fiscal austerity in the States, that's kind of a key concern, naturally. I think what they're, from what I've read and from having spoken to people involved in it seems to be that they're looking for as lean a structure as possible and as light a structure, but operational kind of effectiveness. And so not a huge kind of troops on the ground presence, but very kind of lean tactical and strategic security support in terms of planning, in terms of engagement, and bolstering their defense capabilities, because there are, as you pointed out, I mean, they don't have the capacity to do this, and they never have done to really defend themselves as a bloc against Iran or any other actor, were it to come to that. So
Right.
I think if we can kind of, if there's a way of balancing that, I think there's still a need for that kind of security protection.
But let's turn for a second to the GCC in general. With the exception of Bahrain, we haven't seen any serious effects of the Arab Spring on these societies. And I mean, we haven't seen sort of the demonstrations and the rioting that have happened in Tunisia and Egypt and now in Syria or in Yemen and in any of the GCC countries with the exception of Bahrain, right? I mean,
Well, I disagree with that. I think, okay, you had obviously you had the demonstrations in Oman, and you had a conservative estimate of 2 deaths, but you had
right.
bloggers, and you've had sort of activists that have been arrested, silenced,
Right.
jailed, or on trial in every single one of the Gulf countries. You've seen, I think the most recent demonstration in Kuwait was 12,000 protesters out on the street demanding the removal of the prime minister. So, and even in Saudi, you've had a lot more public criticism that's now being voiced by the next generation, with no regard to kind of convention, long-standing convention. So these things have changed, and I think that there has been a ramping up of pressure. And you've also had kind of several political moves on the part of the ruling family, such as, the Federal National Council elections, pseudo kind of democratic experiment in the UAE, as well as Qatar's commitment to
Elections.
elections, in 2013. And these are sort of piecemeal attempts to sort of rectify the problem, and at the same time, the massive subsidies again. The
Right.
150 odd billion that have been pledged and committed. And I know that people working on the kind of economic plans within the diwans, within the ministries, okay, yes, they're thinking along econometric lines, but they're not thinking about the political and social kind of ramifications of these act, of these acts and distributing these grants and how that will play out. Because you really can't embark on such ambitious plans with so little outreach and engagement with constituents, and that kind of complete absence, of that engagement. It's becoming more and more of a powder keg, and I think it's crunch time. It's a very urgent situation at the moment. They've got to decide, which direction they're going to go in, or
But
you know, go in.
don't you think the fact that they have all this money because of oil and gas exports that has played that has dampened the potential for massive uprising in these countries?
It might have contained it in the short term. But in fact, when it comes to actually spending, because they've committed to spending, but they haven't actually begun to do this. And once the implications of the spending, these spending plans are start to be felt, and people realize, there was a very, very good article by a Gulf-based economist, and he was saying that the cost of, building hundreds of thousands of homes in Saudi, in fact, the cost of maintaining and the upkeep of these homes and the energy spend of each house exceeds the cost of building it. And the kind of the impact on each country's GDP, it's not sustainable. It's absolutely not sustainable. So even though they've got
Yeah,
sort
I
of
mean,
20 billion
also
committed, yeah. Sorry.
I mean, the real issue with a lot of these expenditure promises or actual expenditures, because in the case of Saudi Arabia, they give 2 extra months of salary to all public employees,
Right.
which is very significant given that something like 90% of the Saudi population, working population, works for the public sector and not the private sector. But if you factor in how much the promises, how much they mean in terms of needing a price of oil to be at a certain level in order to maintain a balanced budget,
Yeah.
the what is called the break-even price
Yes.
of oil has gone up, very significantly in Saudi Arabia, from something like $50 a barrel to something between 70 and perhaps even
I think that is
eighty
too.
dollars a barrel. So if the price of oil were ever to come down again below 80, a country like Saudi Arabia, but I imagine a number of other countries would have a real hard problem balancing their budget, and they would go into deficit just to maintain the promises that they've now made to their population.
So how do we tie this? How do we tie these kind of spending plans, if you like, to this sort of new NATO defense architecture? And I mean, how would we kind of, what would your advice be to sort of the US government going forward in terms of how it would manage this trade-off, if you like, and the potential implications of it?
Well, I mean, I think if I were speaking to the US government, I would tell them that, maybe looking out 5 years, things will probably not be that you won't see anything dramatic happening in terms of regimes being toppled or coups or revolutions in the Gulf states. But looking further out, you have real problems. And these problems have to do with, a number of issues. One of them is a very sharp rise in birth rates, and I mean a continued high rate of birth, which means that the populations are growing at a remarkable pace. Unlike in Iran, where the population, in fact, has come down in terms of its percentage growth per year. That's one issue looking out. The other issue is that the domestic consumption of energy is at an all-time high and is growing sort of very, very dramatically. So that looking out, if Saudi Arabia keeps consuming the way it is consuming by 2025, 2028, it will need about 6 million barrels of oil just for its domestic consumption, which is pretty much what India consumes today on a daily basis. So, you'll have a population of perhaps 30 to 40 million people consuming or needing as much oil and gas as a population of 1.2 billion people. I mean, these are very dramatic sort of numbers. And ultimately, I think the US should be very worried, looking out a decade or further, about the stability of these countries. For the reasons that I outlined, partly economic, partly population, partly to do with natural resource use, and also the fact that the leadership structure in all of these countries and how leadership is passed on from one person to another is not always very predictable.
I mean, I absolutely agree. I think it's a big problem. I think it's even closer than I mean, the 2025 is the like kind of the outer limit of the cutoff point, because you've still got kind of Oman and Bahrain rapidly running out of assets and expertise in terms of how it deals with that that shortfall. So I think, even though with Saudi you've got a slight margin of delay because of its oil reserves, I think it's more contracted than that. In particular, you look at the UAE, there've been so many I mean, massive corruption issues, and in terms of the budget deficits, and in terms of how much money is going missing at certain levels, and it's problematic. This amount of funds, this amount of misspending, and I think the margin and the kind of patience of people. I'm not sure that it will hold out for that long, and I think it's a much more pressing concern, even closer. That, you know, there's so long you can kind of contain certain actors and dissent and whatnot before something needs to be done. And even if it were to disregard dissent, there's still these kind of issues that you mentioned in terms of renewable energy, the lack of it, subsidizing the fuel and oil. We've seen that even in the UAE very recently, with petrol stations unable to, because of the subsidies and the law. Within the UAE, there's almost a fuel crisis in certain respects in terms of the policy, the energy policy itself. So I think you're already seeing an impact. I think waiting that long to kind of reorient its thinking, especially when it's going in now in terms of a NATO agreement, a NATO-like agreement, it doesn't make sense. And if I can perhaps come back to your points about, you were saying the two big kind of threats particularly was an American, okay, the fiscal expenditure, but you were also raising the point about Al-Qaeda. And from my perspective, I think this is kind of overstated in a sense, but there's a whole other swathe of criticism. Certainly people who are just generally disaffected, whether or not they're, you know, that as extreme as Al-Qaeda, but certainly, you know, the whole of the NATO defense architecture is geared towards, if you like, Iran and Iraq. But for me, I think both parties absolutely missing the picture. The biggest kind of strategic threat is Yemen. The projection is for within, you know, the next 6 months for it to become the next Somalia. And you've got millions of very young Yemenis who are running out of food and fuel and resources. There's water scarcity. There's potential for it to be tremendous kind of migratory pressures into the rest of the GCC, because they will have, and they currently even, they have nowhere to go. And so this forced projection, as you put it, it's kind of, to my mind, I think it's going in absolutely the wrong direction. And I don't think it's necessarily, you know, Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula that's the problem. It's what do you do with a tremendous amount of impoverished, disaffected, marginalized Yemenis who are knocking on the door of the GCC in the face of, as you put it, you know, a very kind of an extraordinarily militarized Gulf. I feel both sides, both the US and the GCC, are kind of missing, and the defense chiefs particularly, are missing the bigger picture about the potential implications. They can try and close the borders to Yemen, but this is another thing that they're going to have to deal with far more soon and far more quickly and far more in a much more tangible way than they'll have to do with kind of Iran, despite, you know, what might be going on in terms of missile productions and kind of games and war games in the Gulf.
I agree with you that Yemen is the major threat to the GCC. And I don't think, in fact, that border between Yemen and Saudi Arabia, and ultimately Oman as well, can, in fact, be protected. It's way too long. I mean, it's over, I think it's over 1,000 miles long, or 1,600 kilometers long. And it's all, most of it is desert, with the empty quarter. And I don't think you can stop Yemenis who look just like Saudis and, you know, are Arabs and Muslims and are not only hungry and angry, but also militarized. I mean, the Yemenis have a lot of weaponry as well. Mm-hmm. It's one of the most, you know, weaponized countries in the world.
Yeah.
And so, you know, Yemenis will, if there's a civil war, there's an implosion in Yemen, I think many Yemenis, millions perhaps, will just walk across the border. And I don't think you can keep them in refugee camps.
Yeah, I mean,
you know, they're not sub-Saharan Africans who are very distinct population in Arabia. They're not. I mean, they're just like other GCC peoples.
And there's already there are estimates of at least 500,000 IDPs already within the country, internally displaced persons. And so, you know, the impact
Yeah.
again for refugees is tremendous. Given also too that there are that, you know, hundreds of thousands of Yemenis already in, you know, the Gulf in you know, the security positions and the military, and they're already sort of present. They've got family. They've got agnatic ties already.
Yeah.
And I think
Yeah,
this is just another thing that they
and I
hadn't
don't
thought
do you
of.
see I mean do you see in the GCC I mean do you, in Saudi Arabia I know there's absolutely no virtually no thinking being done about this problem. They're just hoping that President Saleh, who's now back in Yemen, can revert to the status quo ante, what happened before, which is namely that he kept the place more or less stable for the from the perspective of the Saudis, which I don't think he can do anymore.
He's part
But
of the problem, yeah.
in the in the UAE, do you see any thought or policy being developed with respect to Yemen?
I think they've got the very kind of benign committed. They are committed. They are concerned about it. They're kind of keenly aware of what's going on there. But Saudi's the big kind of the sleeping giant, if you like, on this. And this is why
Yeah.
I think it comes back to the succession issue again. I think these, you know, as the portfolios have been slightly reshuffled with the governor of Riyadh and with the defense portfolio, I think the most important one in the next year is the foreign policy role. And at the moment, it's not filled by someone who's competent or capable enough in order to be able to step up and deal with this. And this is a direct and an immediate kind of lever or pressure on the very inner circle of the Saudi monarch, and it will kind of come to surface. There's no way it can't within the next few months. It's not like dealing with Libya because it's very much in its own backyard,
Yeah.
and these kind of pressures. I think this is why the succession issue is even more critical now, and the current kind of governance structure in Saudi. And if I can just sort of depict slightly, you know, what it's like. It's very difficult because you've got a very an older generation of Saudi rulers, and at the same time you have a very very young kind of Khaliji UAE and Gulf population. And I've got to be honest, having grown up partly in Saudi in the US and UK, but partly in Saudi, what I can see is that there's very little understanding between, you know, the Gulf counterparts of what Saudi's thinking or how they've behaved or their historical kind of legacy, why they've ever even entered into a US defense relationship, and, you know, what drove it and what was the ask on the other kind of, you know, the Saudis bought a hell of a lot of arms from the US, but what did they get in return and what were the guarantees and the assurances? Now, the UAE, for instance, is the number one recipient of US arms at the moment, the number one importer of US military products, more so than Saudi currently. And yet, okay, so it's got that kind of trade-off, but it doesn't think in the same way that Saudi used to. It doesn't know what it wants out of the relationship in the same kind of way. It doesn't leverage that kind of relationship in the way that the Saudis did. And again, there's a kind of strategic disconnect. They don't understand each other. They don't know how each other works. Certainly, there's a lot of distrust. It may be united on certain fronts in terms of Gulf-wide foreign policy, as it looks out to sort of, you know, Libya or Egypt, for instance. But there's a tremendous amount of misunderstanding because
Yeah.
it's partly generational, and this has implications for, you know, a potential NATO shield.
Yeah. I'm not sure actually that one can generalize about the GCC when it comes to foreign policy. I mean, I think that, for instance, Qatar and Saudi Arabia are often at odds. On the revolutions, for instance, the Qataris were very much in favor of the Egyptian uprising or revolution, and the Saudis are very much against it. They weren't always on, they're not always on the same page, and there are significant tensions between them. And because Saudi is so much bigger and so much more powerful than the other GCC countries, and Saudi regards the other GCC countries as city states, not real con not countries in the full sense of the term. There is a big brother, younger brother sort of dynamic that happens in the relationship between these countries, especially vis-a-vis Saudi Arabia. And you can see this in the monetary currency. There was the plan for a union of the currency of the GCC countries, and a dispute flared over where the headquarters of the central bank would be, whether it would be in Riyadh or in Abu Dhabi. And finally, I don't think anything ever came of it, and the currencies are still not united, even though all of them, with one exception, I think, are pegged to the US dollar.
Yeah, with
So they
the
maintain
exception of Kuwait, yeah.
right, with the exception of Kuwait. So they maintain more or less the same value regardless. But the monetary union hasn't gone very far, and now looking forward, I'm not sure that the Qataris, who have a very special relationship with Iran, as do the Omanis and Oman, I don't know whether they would be fully on board with the very anti-Iranian line that the Saudis are now have now adopted. I mean, the Qataris share a major oil field, gas field rather, with Iran, and the Omanis, as well as the people, as well as the ruler of Dubai, have very strong ties with, at least commercial ties with Iran, and I'm not sure they'd be willing to jeopardize them just because the Saudis or the Americans want them to cease those relationships.
I think there's several points there. Yeah, absolutely. It's not homogenous, and it doesn't act in as a bloc necessarily. However, since the unrest, I think it has tried to pull together and marshal its resources kind of more effectively and more work in a more unified way. I think there will always be internal border kind of issues, whether or not it's on the borders, on trucking disputes, monetary union, the customs union, businesses, all of these issues are going to continue at an internal level. But their kind of outward projection, I think, has become more solidified than ever. And I think they were very united, potentially with the exception of Oman, particularly with the GCC Peninsula Shield that went in. And they were very defensive, and they're very forthright, and they're very kind of aggressive about it being their right to kind of defend their assets against Iran and that kind of thing. So you saw cohesion on that front. And when it comes to sort of differences between, say, the Qataris and Saudi, I mean, if I'm being really honest, I think the Qatari foreign policy towards actors like Syria has never been logical. It's been completely irrational. I mean, they've viewed Bashar al-Assad, in a very kind of benign way historically, and the regime as if it's sort of in a very inferior way. And I don't know whether or not it's a measure of arrogance kind of that's underlying that kind of impulse, but certainly they've mis I in my opinion they've misread their own capacity as regards kind of Iran and with regard to Syria in particular. That they've kind of jumped the gun and they've inserted themselves in several. I mean, sometimes they've acted quite gracefully, but yes, they have acted certainly at loggerheads at other times. And I think there's probably it speaks to your overarching point that I would never say that it's a counter-revolutionary Gulf or that it's a pro-revolutionary Gulf, either one of these actors. Saudi has cultivated for years links with the Ikhwan in Egypt and North Africa, for instance, and with the Ikhwan in Syria, as well as with statist oppositions, even if they were angered in the UAE, particularly by the fall of Mubarak. It's not to say that they won't continue to support the regimes moving forward, particularly in the handouts. And they've announced 3 billion for the Khalifa Fund from the UAE towards Egypt as an example of that. So it's a much more pragmatic relationship that they have with these states than simply counter-revolutionary or non. But I think you can see that with the final kind of outcome, when they do sort of say things as the GCC and they're very emphatic about it, it is cohesive. And one of the things that they have done with this wider GCC, I don't know if you read about this, was to make an offer to Morocco and Jordan for them to join the GCC as an extended kind of monarchical structure. It was a Saudi driven initiative. It wasn't particularly well received initially and didn't make much sense from the government's on the other side. They weren't sure about it, and they didn't know where it'd come from and what the reasons behind it were. But then they got behind it and they rallied, and they were very firm about it. But then if you look at the domestic populations within the Gulf about this particular alignment, they're grossly dissatisfied. They do not want an extended union with Morocco and Jordan. And again, this is another issue that will have implications for this new GCC kind of security architecture. if the US is defending the GCC, and if the GCC then includes Jordan, which means that you've now got a GCC border with Palestine, what are the implications again, with Israel, rather, of that? Whose side are they going to kind of take? Again, I think these are one of the kind of concerns that people potentially might not be looking at.
No, yeah, I mean, I think you're right. I don't know whether the plan to include Jordan and Morocco was, you know, how well conceived it was or how long in the planning it was. I imagine it was a fairly ad hocish, last minute decision that had to do with rallying sort of the forces of traditionalism and stability versus those of revolutionary, zeal and uprisings and toppling of regimes. And the Saudis backed it up, at least with the Jordanian case, with money, with handouts. I'm not sure if they gave anything to Morocco. I don't think they have.
Well, they've promised, and it has yet to come through. So you've seen kind of repeated delegations from the Jordanian side and representations towards the Gulf countries to ensure that that happens. And they're kind of very committed to moving forward. So it's stated in principle, and it's being kind of very intensively pushed forward by the Jordanian side in particular, because obviously there are so many benefits that they'd accrue being part of these Gulf monarchies, not least the business and interest in that kind of thing.
So. Yeah, I mean, as someone who lives in Dubai and has been to all these countries, I mean, visiting them, you feel they're quite different. I mean, in their feel.
Yeah.
When you visit Dubai, let's say, which is much more relaxed, open, permissive, mm-hmm. than somewhere like Riyadh, for instance, especially for you, let's say, as a woman, there are very distinct differences socially and publicly between these different places. How do you navigate or negotiate these? And since you have access to women, someone like me doesn't when I go to Saudi, or very rarely do. Do you find that women have a different take or a different position, or are more engaged than, let's say, the men that you meet when it comes to demanding political reforms or looking out into the future?
I think it's tied to education, particularly in political education, because there's such a lack of it in the Gulf. So the women are more educated than the men, increasingly so, especially in Saudi, I suppose. But it's to such different populations. I think in Saudi, obviously, we know that the population there is extraordinarily conservative. And even though the majority of men and women kind of approve of the right to drive, for instance, in the UAE, they don't get why it would have been banned in the first place. It's not that there's apathy. It's just that people express their kind of activism with a kind of a degree of quietism. I mean, that they express their concerns in a very kind of in a non kind of threatening way. And they don't coalesce in terms of groups. They're more likely to want to get involved in the business community and that kind of thing. And empowerment is very much tied to kind of economic opportunity for women. And it, again, as you said, it varies from state to state. And I think that's one of the biggest demographic kind of drivers, if you like, for action in Saudi particularly. Because as they're more educated, they're younger now. And they're not sort of like the generation that was raised there sort of 20, 30 years ago. They're less willing to kind of compromise, I think. But at the same time, they are still conservative in Saudi. So what they are going to compromise or what they're going to sort of appeal for are not necessarily a women driving campaign and this kind of thing. I think there are other priorities in terms of their economic rights, the right to work, yeah. to assistance and these kind of things that take precedence. Over whatever anyone else that sort of outside of the country is talking about. But
I was also going to ask you whether you found that with the social media and with the new media, Twitter, Facebook, what have you, mm-hmm. that younger people have become more engaged politically or more critical, or do you find that these technologies are really being used purely for social and not political purposes?
I think it's both. I mean, I think in Bahrain, it's, I mean, you've always had a small cadre of people, and particularly liberals or ultra-nationalists in each of the Gulf states who've always kind of expressed their views online. It's often gotten into trouble for it. There's now a new generation of Khalijis that are online, and even the expats and the migrants within these communities who are online and expressing their views about whichever issue. In Bahrain, it almost backfired because there were so many accounts, so many kind of trolls. It was a very kind of toxic environment online, on social media and whatnot. But this is partly because of the clampdown with the state and any kind of national press or any media outlet, because there's so little opportunity for them to voice their concerns within recognized channels, and the censorship is so severe, and it increased dramatically. Even when I was, I spent the last year on the editorial team of a newspaper, and the self-censorship was absolutely rampant. And as a result, because you've got this narrow political space, and because there's nowhere really for these young people to kind of express views freely and be represented in a way that kind of reflects, their concerns. Again, Twitter is one of their only, or Facebook is one of their only outlets and sources of discussion. So, it's a very difficult situation because, again, the self-censorship and the red line has shifted and has regressed to such an extent that one can't discuss general kind of political topics such as constitutional monarchies or democracy, or really get to grips with it, or talk about. I mean, no one again has analysed any of the military spending, the surveillance that has been going on. The spending and surveillance has increased dramatically, and obviously that has direct implications. And I mean, even myself, I was like continually advised sort of pipe down, because I was one of the first people to speak up on the detention of activists in the UAE, and I was continually advised, no, that let someone else do it, let it be someone else's problem, and you're not poking the dragon, this kind of thing. And it's very sad. And so people use a really wide variety of ways in order to kind of circumvent, or to or sometimes they don't even bother out of fear. And I feel like it's quite tragic actually, because it's going in the same direction as Saudi is in the UAE in particular. And obviously you've got that throughout the rest of the Gulf. And in Kuwait you've had a blogger arrested. It's
I mean, I've always, in my experience when I've been there, I've always felt that the native people, leaving aside that, in the UAE and with the exception of Saudi Arabia, most people living in these societies in these countries are foreigners, foreign guest workers. And the local population is tiny, is minuscule. In Qatar, I think there are about 150,000 of them, of the locals. And then the remaining million plus are foreigners. But I've always felt that the local population, the native population, has, because of the political system, has been, and the oil and the co-optation through money and so on, that they've been infantilized. They've been sort of turned into children by the rulers. They've been turned, they're treated like children, and as a result, the relationship is one of, father to son or father to daughter, so that the subject of the state, these people, expect the state to do everything for them, to provide them with, free medical care, free education, free housing, free travel, free, everything, jobs and so on. And the state in turn, because it's able to do so, provides all these services. But should the state not be able to provide the services, you would have, like a child, you very likely to result in a tantrum in the form of social protest and movements emerging. And also, at some point, the children may decide that, we don't want to be children anymore, despite all the money that's thrown at us and all the services that are provided free to us, that we might want to now object and criticize. And that day, sooner or later, will come. I mean, either one of these scenarios, sooner or later, I think will come. And I don't see any of these regimes really preparing for that day.
Well, it's even this exchange, this very brief exchange about the nature of dissent in the Gulf, is enough to raise an incredible amount of ire, and it's and to have political repercussions for having said all these things. And to some extent, I agree about the kind of kind of paternalistic nature of the relationship there. And I see it as a tragedy, if you like. It really is, because, as you say, if citizens aren't empowered, and if they view kind of, you know, or any stakeholders in the Gulf, if they're not free to kind of constructively criticize and act as stakeholders and participate in their own kind of futures and their own, you know, their own governance structures, you know, it's tremendous. It's tremendously sad. And yes, you know, it could lead to kind of blowback, or, as you say, they could one day sort of decide that they, yes, have to grow up. But I think it takes a very consistent and concerted and very a very intellectually honest kind of commitment to be able to make those changes. And because it's going the absolute opposite direction, where any criticism of state structures is taken in a very bad way at the moment.
Yeah.
And we're hoping it's a short-term thing and that after a year it will calm down somewhat. But in the interim, again, when this is the time when they most need to sort of, when people most need to sit up and say, actually, you know, let's have a really good think about subsidy spending relative to our military output. I mean, because that's not happening, again, the risks, you know, multiply, and it compounds it again. And so, you know, even though this is a very risky conversation for the Gulf, I think it's one worth having, and I hope that, you know, that more are encouraged to do so here. And that's my only hope, really, is that they kind of continue to commit to looking at things not as if it was an attack, but as if it was, you know, part of their evolution.
Yeah, and it's part of, it's constructive criticism. It's not meant out of malice.
Absolutely.
No, I agree. I'm not sanguine. I mean, I'm actually not very hopeful or optimistic that that change will come or reform will come, unless there's a real crisis, and a real crisis by which I mean a collapse in the price of oil and gas.
Right.
I think that as long as these governments have the resources, the financial resources that accrue to them,
mm-hmm.
you know, in such huge quantities because of the price of oil and gas, they will be able to kick the proverbial can down the road indefinitely.
Yeah.
By essentially buying off dissent. And silencing it.
It's yeah. Well, it's mainly that no one's willing. People have to be willing to kind of sort of say, okay, where is the spending going? Even if you're giving me a house now, this will mean for certain that my children will not be able to afford to live here.
Yeah.
And it's as simple as that.
But it requires a major reorientation and attitude too. Actually, what it really requires is the person to say, no, I don't want you to provide me a house.
Yeah.
I want you to provide me with, you know, a private sector job, or allow me to work so that I can afford enough money to buy my own house.
Or invest in my education enough that I've got the skills to be able to do it, which is really kind of a big issue.
And that's where, I mean, you become a real stakeholder, is when you've actually, you know, spent your own sweat and tears on the achievements that you have, rather than having been given them for nothing.
Absolutely.
Just by virtue of,
you know, and if actors throughout the Gulf were to sit up and say, okay, yes, we realize this, we realize that, and, you know, it's an awakening of domestic political consciousness, whether or not they realize that actually, you know, concepts, because this realization doesn't exist at the moment. If people realize that their political participation is linked to the distribution of resources very directly, in a way that it wasn't, you know, I mean, they could have said, okay, we had majlises 30 years ago, but because the populations have exploded, none of those mechanisms are sufficient anymore. And because that realization between political participation and the kind of economic rights hasn't dawned on people. And until that time happens, and perhaps it will happen, but until it happens, yes, it's not a good outlook. Which is, it's very worrying.
Yeah, it is. It is. And but we'll see. We'll see how things develop.
Yeah.
We've gone over now the hour limit, I think.
Yes, I think we have. Shukran very much. Thank you so much.
No, it's a pleasure. This was fun.
Yeah.
This was fun, and I will. I'll save these files and send them on. I think you should do the same.
Yeah. Thank you very much again.
Thank you. I hope we'll meet at some point.
I hope so too. Bye.
Take care.
Bye.
Bye. Bye.